Okay, let's get started. This is my name is Janet Warburton, and I'm here to welcome you on behalf of ARCUS for Live from IPY. And today we have, I'm not sure, who are we talking to on the Healy today?
How do I do it?
Healy, do I still have you?
Yes.
Who's on the Healy?
Hello. Yeah. Robin Powell is here.
Maggie Profenis is here.
Emily Davenport is here.
Jeff Knapp. Now it's you, Roberta.
AJ is here.
Okay. I'm sorry, Healy people, but we only heard part of you be introduced. You need to either get closer to the phone or speak up. So we lost it after Robin.
Uh-oh. Maggie Provenis.
Alex D. Robertus.
Jeff Knapp.
Emily Davenport.
AJ LeBeaver.
And Rob Pryor.
Okay. Great.
Maggie and Rob are students with Jeff Knapp and Zooplankton.
Okay. Thanks. I'm just going to let you guys start talking about where you are and what you're doing out in the Bering Sea. So I don't know, Robin or Maggie, do you want to take the lead on that? Why are you out in the Bering Sea and what are you doing? Where are you?
Well, we're north of the Pribilof Island, steaming down towards Cape George, where we're going to land tomorrow and do some community education with the folks on that island. And the reason why we're out in the Bering Sea is because there are a number of scientists who have created a collaborative learning and researching environment, and they are collecting data to see what's happening in the Bering Sea at this time.
Okay. And how long are you guys going to be on the ship?
We are still going to be on the ship until May 12th, but actually the scientists that we have with us today will actually be leaving on Saturday.
Oh. Okay. I know that today you guys wanted to talk a little bit about introduce the two researchers and what they were doing. So I think we'll just start with that and then we'll have open it up for questions. So whichever researcher you'd like to start presenting, go ahead.
All right, well, I guess it's going to be, it'll be Alex De Robertus. And he will be talking about acoustics and looking at fish and plankton through sound. So, here you go.
Are we going to be doing the slides or should we just talk about it? Can they see the slides on the other end?
We can see slides on the other end for the most part. But if you describe them, there are some people that don't have the visuals. So if you kind of talk about what we are seeing, that would be great.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll go ahead and my name is Alex Giovertis. I work at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, which is in Seattle, not Alaska, believe it or not. And what I'm doing on this cruise is using acoustics to look at fish and plankton. And if you look at my first slide there, what you see is you see a map of the Bering Sea, and you see the ice cover there. And what we're really interested in is how the ice cover affects the distribution and abundance of fish and plankton. And what you can see here is that the purple part is where there's really heavy ice, and there's our ship track is in red. So you can see we've been up in the areas in the Northern Bering Sea where there's quite a bit of ice. And it's really important because there's a very large fishery in the Bering Sea during summer months. And not much is known about what goes on in the wintertime when it's ice covered, because it's hard to get to. So I'm going to go to my next slide.
Okay.
This shows the web, and all the little arrows show how all the different animals, plants, and nutrients are connected to each other, and I've kind of grayed out most of it. The important part, for me at least, is the part that's not very light. It's large zooplankton, fish, and people, and that's kind of the part of the marine food web that that I work on. Let me go to the next slide. And so I've mentioned this earlier. One of the goals of this cruise in terms of what I'm doing is to try and understand how ice and very cold, near-freezing water affects the abundance of fish and euphausids, which are shrimp-like animals that are really abundant and form the basis of food for a lot of commercially caught fish. And one of the ways that we study fish, typically, is with large nets. And in the next slide, you'll see a picture of a large net with some people standing in it, for those who can't see it. But it's quite a large net, and that's similar to what are used in commercial fisheries. But if you look at the next slide, you'll see the main problem is in ice. The ocean is obviously covered by ice, and you can't really use nets because they get filled up with the ice, and it breaks up the net. So you can't really use that sort of information, and you need a special type of ship, a trawler, to be able to use those nets. So my solution, if you look on the next slide, is to use fish finders. Basically, I use a device called an echo sounder. It's just a fish finder. It sends out a pulse of sound and from a thing called a transducer, which is the part that sends the sound out. And then it sends sound, and which then, go to the next slide, bounces off of the object in the water and comes back. And from that, you can measure how much backscatter or how much sound is coming back off of the animals. And from that, you can make a guess at how many fish there are. On Healy, if you look at the next slide, we set up a bunch of equipment, some electronics, the transducers, which are the parts that send the sound out. We place them inside a transducer well, which has a window which looks out from the bottom of the ship. So we're basically bouncing sound out of the bottom of the ship, off of animals in the water, and counting how many there are. We use two different frequencies. It's almost, they're two different tones. Think of a high-pitched sound and a low-pitched sound. And we use that to classify the animals. If you look at these two diagrams on the next slide, what you see is one taken at low frequency and one at high frequency. If you look at this, the white part is the parts with very low, weak returns. There's a strong brown stripe at the bottom, which is the bottom. And the stuff in the middle there are animals. On the left-hand side, you mostly see fish in red and blue. And on the right-hand side, you'll see those fish and some fuzz. And that fuzz is backscatter from plankton. And so using these two frequencies, we can think of two different colored flashlights, essentially. What we do is we look at these animals in two different views, almost like two sets of sunglasses, and we can tell by which window we're looking through what type of animal they are. The other thing we see that's quite common is animals migrating towards the surface. Here's a layer of fish. It's moving from about 100 meters depth as it gets dark up towards the surface to feed. And that's a real common behavior. In many places, small animals like euphausids, let's say off of Hawaii, will migrate maybe 300 meters. It's equivalent, in human terms, of migrating about 30 miles just to get your dinner. So it's a long way these animals go to. And I just want to tell you a little bit about what we've learned so far on our last slide. We found, overall, that fish and plankton are really much more abundant outside of the ice and outside of the very cold water. But our work's certainly not done. Once we get off the ship on Sunday, I guess Saturday will be, we'll spend quite a lot of time in the laboratory on it, trying to understand the abundance of fish and plankton in relation to predators, their distributions in other seasons, and other environmental features. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Sorry, folks, that's the ship intercom in the background. We'll wait till they're done.
We apologize for that. We called Heinz. They're making an announcement about a field. Trying to sleep on board.
Sorry, we couldn't hear a thing. So repeat what was going on there, Robin.
Quite a few of those during the day, and they're very, very loud. I think
okay.
They're
well, we'll just wait a moment here for them to finish.
Okay.
How about you doing the mobile?
Are they done now?
I think maybe, Jeff, do you want to go off or anything else?
My name is Jeff. I'm looking for the me and Jayla Fever, Rob Fryer, and then another person who couldn't, Susan Hill, family club, and Peter Blunt.
Hey, excuse me, Healy. We can't hear you at all. You're really muffled. You try to speak closer, or I don't know if the connection's getting worse or not.
Okay, try. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
that's better.
That's better.
Speak slowly and clearly.
Barely. How's this? You're a rock star here. Put it right up to my lips. How's that?
That's better. That's better for us. How about the other people?
Okay, we'll get them a mic too so that they can talk as well. But we've been working up here in the Bering Sea for quite a while, and if you look at my first slide, it's titled the Bering Sea Ecosystem, a Sea of Change, and that's because we've been seeing quite a few changes in the past decade. When we look at both the physical conditions and the animals and the organisms we see. So our little group here is working on the plankton. Those are animals, plants, and animals that float around in the water and aren't quite strong enough to swim against the currents. So if we go to the next slide here. I'm sorry, hold on. Okay, so if we go to the second slide, just to give you some perspective of how large the area is where we're studying, we have a map of the eastern Bering Sea, and you can see that the whole state of California fits easily into this shelf area here, and there's still room for more. So it's a huge area for us to try to cover and sample. And that's one of the real difficulties is part of it's covered by ice in the spring, part of it isn't. Some of the ships, like this icebreaker, can go into the ice. Others can't even get to the edge. So it's a very difficult place to study. I think they're all negotiating things. The next slide, three, just to give you the rationale for why NOAA is up here. We're responsible for both the fisheries and many of the marine mammals that are found in this area. And about half of the U.S. Fish catch is from the Bering Sea. And you can see from those bar graphs that it's been fairly stable over the years. What's shown there is the weight of the catch. That's both from the eastern Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. And so Alaska, the ecosystem here is really important for supplying seafood for the rest of the country. And here's a slide of some of the seafood products or some of the products you might see in the market that you don't realize come from Alaska seafood. Everything from, you know, salmon steaks, which are sort of obvious, to hot dogs and fish fertilizer down there on the lower right, the BioGrow. So quite a few things that people don't realize, including that fake crab called surimi that the Japanese make. That's from one of the largest fisheries in the U.S. The fish is called pollock, and we're going to talk just a little bit more about that because they're very abundant up here.
Daddy?
As I said, the National Marine Fisheries Service is also responsible for endangered and threatened marine mammals, and we have a field team here on the cruise, and a little later they're going to talk at one of the other sessions about their work they're doing. But just to briefly mention that things like the stellar sea lion, humpback whales, bowhead whales, right whales, they all depend on the productivity of the ecosystem and the productivity of the plankton to be able to survive and reproduce, and so it's important for us to be up here studying the conditions that either favor their survival or make it more difficult for them to live and reproduce. So as I said, we've been up here with a concentrated effort for the last 10 years and, you know, sort of working with the physical oceanographers and the meteorologists in NOAA, we've been measuring temperature from moorings. You can see on this next slide, there's a surface float which has a tower on it with a bunch of instruments that measure things like wind speed and air temperature. But below that float are strings of current meters and thermometers. And those thermometers are measuring the temperature every 20 minutes. And we've been doing that now for about 12 years. And you can see on that graph a big change in the wintertime temperatures at that site. You see that from about 1995 up to 99, that the winter temperatures got down below zero to minus two. But after 2000, the ice didn't come down to that location for about 5 years, and there was significant warming, not only in the winter, but the summer temperatures were warmer as well, and that has a large impact on the animals. Here's a figure from my colleague Phyllis Stavenow. She's one of the physical oceanographers we work with. And it's just a diagram to show you the difference in ice among the different decades. So we go back all the way to about 1972 or 1973, and you can see in the mid-70s we had quite a bit of ice. And then all of a sudden in the 80s there was a moderate amount of ice, and then in 2000 again the ice went to very, very low levels. And some of the animals have evolved to take advantage of that ice or use those cold conditions for part of their, you know, life history, either for their growing or finding food or finding mates. So part of the expedition up here is to understand better what is the role of sea ice in the lives of the organisms that are important to us, because sea ice has been disappearing from the Bering Sea in the last decade or so. So here are some pictures taken of some of the animals we study. These are things that are food for whales and fish. On the left is a copepod, Calanus. It's about 4 millimeters, or let's say about a grain of rice, of white rice. And the thing to the right is a euphausid, also commonly called krill. And those are, let's see, 20 millimeters, which would be, what's 20 millimeters? About an inch, a little shorter than an inch, 2.54 is an inch, but it's a little less than an inch. And both these things are very high in lipids, and so they're really good food for whales and fish, and they come in patches that the fish and the whales seek out and try to gorge themselves. Okay. One of the things that we've seen recently is that copepod that was on the left hand of the last slide has been disappearing from the eastern Bering Sea during the warm periods. This graph here shows its abundance in September, I think, from some work done by some colleagues of mine. And you can see the red sort of areas are where it's highest. And it used to be abundant in that whole area that's diagrammed in blue. But now, with the warmer years, the abundance has been much, much less. And it's important because some organisms, like the right whale, which we'll see on the next slide, tend to feed almost exclusively on that animal. So there's a picture of the right whale, the northern Pacific right whale. It is endangered now. There's only, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, but I think there's on the order of 20 to 40 individuals left that visit the Bering Sea, the eastern Bering Sea each year, maybe even fewer. And the pictures on the left just show you the difference from 1 year to the next in the abundance of its food. So in 2000, we were out here in the summer, we were towing along nets, and we emptied our nets onto that sieve, and you can see how red it is. There's thousands of animals on that sieve right now, but we came back at almost the same time the next summer in 2001, and after we towed our nets, there was hardly anything in them. And that's a real problem for animals like this that have migrated so long to come up here and feed. The last thing I want to talk about is something called ocean acidification.
Okay.
Because of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, I think you've all heard that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing. And,
you want to hear it? You're talking to Healy.
Sorry. Sorry, there's a classroom that we're getting
into. Yeah, we are really close to getting to lunch and getting kind of rest. Will there be a
question? I couldn't hear you very well, but was that about asking questions?
Yes, because the kids, as you said, have to go to lunch, and they are getting kind of restless.
Okay. Jeff, is it all right if we interrupt you for a moment and have some of the students ask questions?
Sure, we'll go ahead and take questions.
Okay, so was that Mrs. G?
Okay, we are here.
Okay, go. I'm not sure which teacher was asking about the questions, but go ahead, whoever it is.
Hello?
Yes?
I was wondering, where do ice algae grow when the ice melts?
I'm sorry?
I was wondering, where do ice algae grow when the ice melts?
Wow, what a great question. I think I'll have AJ handle that one.
I'll let Jeff take it.
That's an excellent question. We think that the ice algae are one of the things that start the whole spring bloom, because the algae that are living in the ice are a different kind than normally live in the water. So we've been going along on this cruise and collecting the algae from underside the ice, because when the ice melts, they do go in the water and start and continue to grow. But at some point, they settle out and fall down to the bottom.
Can you explain what a bloom is? Hello? Healy?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So a bloom is basically when you have the conditions that allow for the phytoplankton to grow at a very quick rate, so that stuff aren't able to grow at the same rate as they do. So you have a larger increase in the phytoplankton than the rate that the things that eat them are, so you have a whole bunch of phytoplankton.
Okay. Is there
it's a little bit...
Go ahead.
It's kind of like... Yeah, I have a comment. This is Alex. It's kind of like when your grass grows in the spring. At some point in the wintertime, your grass doesn't grow very fast, and the spring comes, and all of a sudden it's time to take the lawnmower out of it. Sort of like that.
Okay. Is there another question from Mrs. G's group?
Oh, we have two more questions, I think.
Okay.
Hi, Miss G, it's Blake, and I wondered if people in Alaska eat seaweed.
He's wondering if people in Alaska eat seaweed.
Oh, well, we're looking around for, I'm getting a positive over on the side. One of the scientists is shaking their heads up and down. So, yes, limu is eaten in Alaska. Great question.
Okay, next question.
Okay, here's the next one.
Hi, Mr. P, this is Jacob. How much sunlight gets through the ice? Does it ever get too thick for sunlight to get through?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Okay. How much sunlight gets through the ice? Does it ever get too thick for sunlight to get through?
Oh, how much sunlight gets through the ice? What a wonderful question. I'm going to give it over to Rob to answer that one.
Yeah, so basically as long as it's thin enough for the sunlight to penetrate, you're going to have some type of phytoplankton growth underneath. The ice we've encountered, you guys can hear me?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
So the ice we've encountered lately within the last 3 to 4 days, I'd say has been relatively thin, maybe less than a meter. I don't know, maybe roughly about a foot. And before that, maybe close to 3 to 4 feet, so over a meter. Where we didn't see as much phytoplankton under the ice. So obviously the thinner the ice, we're seeing more phytoplankton as the ship passes through and the ice is overturned, and you can probably see that on maybe some of the web shots that have been posted. I personally know of one that I took that shows it pretty nicely. So I don't know, anybody else have any comments?
This is AJ, and I would just like to add that another thing that makes it so less sunlight gets through would be when it snows. So the ice itself is pretty clear, and so the sunlight can get through, but when you have snow piling up on top of it, then you get less light, sunlight going through.
Hey, this is Jeff, and we have been measuring that because that's one of the things we're really interested in. People have made those sorts of measurements down in Antarctica, but I don't think they've been made very often here. So we've been drilling holes in the ice and sticking light meters underneath to try to see with the amount of snow and the thickness of ice how the light varies.
Okay.
My question was about the whales that they seen the other day. Just wondering about how many they saw, and also just wondering, since the ice is so thick up there, just wondering how and when they pop up for air. How did they do that through the ice?
Okay. Did you get that, Healy?
Yes, we did. What an excellent question, and here is Robin to explain it.
Oh, okay. So I think it was the killer whales, and how do they breathe through the ice? Basically, they stay in areas where there is no ice, and if they get closed in where the ice does quickly freeze over, they usually make sort of like a circle. They just keep going up over and over again in a breathing circle where one of the whales is constantly going up and keeping the breathing hole open so they can continue to breathe because they are mammals.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. We have a lot of questions from some of the classrooms. Peggy, Feletta, your questions.
Hello, I have a student here, Patrick, who has a question.
Okay, go ahead.
What do you do in your spare time?
No,
all right, when you're bored.
Emily, and I don't have a lot of spare time because we have to sample whenever our multi-core goes down, which could be any time during the day, and so sometimes before night. So sometimes we're working up to 24-hour days. So a lot of my spare time is spent sleeping whenever I get the chance. But some other people on the ship may have more spare time than me.
This
is AJ, and we were actually fortunate enough that Jeff put us on 12 hours on, 12 hours off, so we end up having a lot more spare time than Emily. And although, like Emily, we spend a lot of our spare time sleeping, it takes a little more time than you think to get things done, eating and laundry and things like that. And oftentimes you plan something like, oh, we'll watch a movie in the lounge, but by the time you get there, you get 20 minutes into it and you're asleep. So... Rob, anything?
Well, Donna wants to know if you ever touch the animals.
Is that correct?
Yes, get close enough and touch the animals.
I touch zooplankton all the time. Those are animals.
We touch jellyfish a lot. We have to rinse them off to get the smaller animals off of them to put them in the jars.
As far as the marine mammals, the pinnipeds, the seals, and walrus, they're basically seeing this bright orange ship come through the ice, and they're basically out of the way before anyone can get near.
Although you will be hearing later from the mammal people, and they actually do touch them. They're tagging them, so they sneak up on them and actually, they catch them so that they can put tags on them so they can track them. So they're the only ones who get to touch the big, exciting mammals.
Okay. We have some questions from Megan's group of students. Go ahead, Megan. *6 to unmute your phone. All right. I'm not sure what happened with that. Is there any questions from the museum? I'm going to go round robin and see who else has questions. Jason? Okay. Tanya from St. Paul, do you have any students yet or anybody that wants to ask questions?
I do have some students, and since we weren't able to get on the online internet part, we are currently looking through the journal entries by Robin and Maggie and Emily.
Okay.
So if you could come back to us a little bit later, we'll probably have some questions.
Okay, so that's no problem. Brandon, do your students have any questions?
Yes, I think we have at least one here. Hang on one second.
Okay.
Do you think the conclusions of the research previously mentioned by the marine biologist, such as like the disappearance of the krill, what can be done to prevent the further deterioration of sea life underneath the sea?
Did you get that, Healy? Is anybody there from the Healy? I think we lost the Healy.
Oh, the healing's back on.
Yay. Okay. It says, this is a question for Robert. How does the ice melting affect the endangered species populations mentioned earlier?
A few things. One, in a week or two, you'll hear from the seal folks because there's some seals that are dependent upon the ice, and they can't live without it. That's where they pup and where they molt. But the things that we're studying, they come from the North Water where it's cold, and they need that cold water to grow and all, with all the phytoplankton that's in it. So both those zooplankton that the right whale was that another species I didn't remember or didn't say, the snow crab, which you might see at Sunday buffets and brunches on the table. The snow crab, actually, their larvae feed at the fronts that are created as the ice melts and the phytoplankton begins to grow.
Okay. And we have another question from a student with Brandon Gillette. Using the conclusions of the previously mentioned research, such as the disappearance of the krill, what can be done to prevent the further deterioration of sea life under the ice?
Well, first, we didn't quite say the krill were going to disappear and go extinct. It's just that their abundances have been lower. But, you know, first of all, the ecosystem is reacting to the climate and the weather, and we can't change the climate or weather except for, you know, the types of things that we put into the atmosphere. And so that would be one way, is to be very conscious about what we do in our society that puts things into the atmosphere that then changes climate. Other than that, we just have to react to it and have to try to understand what's going to change and then how we might change our fisheries or what we might do for threatened and endangered species.
All right, Jackie, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Hey, while we're sitting here, would you mind explaining? We have the pictures of the styrofoam cup extent.
Oh, yes, about how why the cups get so small?
Yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, well, you see on the left are the regular styrofoam cups, like you get a cup of hot chocolate when you're out of McDonald's or something. And what they do is everybody gets these color pins and puts them on. Well, styrofoam has got a lot of air in it. And when you put those in a bag, a mesh bag, and like on a piece of equipment that goes deep in the ocean, the pressure gets bigger. It's like if you take your hand around one of those squishy balls and squish it smaller, it makes it smaller because it just condenses it. And so the pressure is causing all the air to go away. Well, once you take styrofoam and push that air out, then it gets tiny. And then you bring it back to the surface, so even though the pressure is less, the cups are very tiny, and so oftentimes you can take a regular McDonald's coffee, hot chocolate cup, it'll shrink way down to only about an inch high.
So I think these are cups from Maggie's school and from Robin's, the after-school program at the museum.
All right, well, you'll enjoy getting them back, and one thing you'll notice are a bit, they're more dense. They feel, I mean, they're still, all that styrofoam now is all condensed small, and they look great.
Thank you, Jackie.
Yes.
So I'm not sure how long of a wait or if they're going to be trying to get back up with us or not. We'll give them a few more minutes. But again, I know that the Seattle Girls School and some other people have lots of questions. If you don't get them answered today, please post them on the website so that Robin and Maggie and Emily can answer your questions.
I don't know if you want an answer about that. I see there's a question about when does the icebreaker not be able, it's impenetrable by the ice. When the ice gets thicker and thicker, this is Jackie Grebmeyer, it gets more pressure like when you go down to the bottom of the ocean. And so it kind of kicks back onto the ship. And when the ice gets about 6, 7, 8 meters, you're not going to break through it. And that's called a pressure ridge, and the ship will back out and find somewhere that's thinner. And you can see that on the picture on the left there. It's pretty solid ahead of the ship, and they'll go back and ram. They'll go forward and back, but if there's a big pressure ridge, they'll go around it.
Okay. Thank you. And then for those of you that are also online, Jackie Grebmeyer is a researcher that will be going out in the Healy in next month, right, Jackie?
About 2.5 weeks, yes.
So when Robin and Maggie get back, Jackie and her crew will be going out on the Healy. All right, guys, I don't know what to think. Hi, was that the Healy?
Yes.
Yay. Okay, I have a question for the Healy. What is the one burning research question that has emerged from your observations on this cruise? Is anybody there from the Healy?
Yes, we are. Maggie and I, just from our observations, Robin, we think it has to do with the ice algae, because last Saturday all the scientists got together and realized they needed to do an experiment on the ice to try to get some of the ice algae and take a look at how quickly the ice algae are making oxygen, which would be their productivity rate, which is what all the scientists pretty much are trying to do in one way or another, to see how much is being made during the day. And so they actually went on the ice, yes, Sunday, and which has been, and then we continued to move on, and then two scientists went back in the helicopter and actually finished up the work. So they got measurements before the sun really got up and going. So that means the plankton was just sort of waking up, and they were all just starting to photosynthesize to make oxygen. And then they went back around 3 o'clock on our chef time, which would be right around noon time here in this area. So it was at maximum level of oxygen, and they took those measurements. So I would say that the one thing they started to realize and come together from what they've done so far here on the ship.
Okay.
Goodbye.
I think there. I don't know if Tanya from St. Paul's School had some questions.
We can start with a couple.
Okay, go ahead. Before we lose them again.
My first question I wanted to ask of Robin and Maggie, will you be willing to do a presentation in the school when you're here on Saturday?
Of course, I'd love to. Absolutely. What time, Tanya?
I don't actually have that figured out yet, but I could get that to you over the next day or so. I understand that you'll be on shore from about 9:30 until probably 3 or 4?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll plan that probably for the morning.
Yes.
Great. And if you had anything that you wanted to show, artifacts, we can put your journal entries up on screen. Anything else you wanted to show us with you.
Are you still there, Maggie and Robin?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, Tanya, do your students have a question?
We had a couple that typed in questions when we lost the Healy, but are being a little bit shy to ask them.
Okay. I'm trying to backtrack and see what they were. Okay, I got it. I'm going to move on then to John Sody. Any of your students, do they have questions since you aren't online?
Oh, we're not online, but I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
How long do you guys spend time on there?
Are you asking how long we're on the ship or how long we're on the ice?
The ship.
The entire cruise is, I think, 5 weeks. But those of us who are actually here right now, at least 4 of us are going to be leaving after 3 weeks.
Bert Hopkins, your students have some questions.
Hi, this is Ravenna. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a comment for Jeff. And I wanted to say that I love him because this is his daughter.
Thank you, man. I miss you too.
Okay.
I'll be home soon.
Bye, Daddy.
Okay. Cheryl, do you have any more questions?
No, I've got my question answered. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody else out there that has some questions? Okay. Thank you, Healy, for having the researchers join you today and being persistent and dialing back many times. Sorry about the technical difficulties. And we will be archiving this event, and so everybody that wasn't able to see it online, you'll be able to see what the slides were after the event and get it from the Polar Trek website. And again, we're going to be talking with the Healy again on May 3rd, right, Robin and Maggie?
Yes.
Okay. And if you guys want to say goodbye, you're welcome to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Robin.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys. Daddy.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Go ahead.
Bye.
Bye.
No. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Have a nice day.